This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
A mosque in Florida draws attention. I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Glad you could spend some time with us on this Father's Day weekend. Here's what's coming up during this program.
Residents in Fort Pierce, Florida are questioning how a local mosque could have been the house of worship for now two terrorists.
On the campaign trail, the Washington politician who's become a favorite as a potential running mate for Republican Donald Trump.
The best Father's Day quotes from the likes of Jimmy Fallon and Mark Twain.
And how shoulder surgery is the new testing ground for alternatives to painkillers.
Everybody, I think, is aware right now that we've got a problem in this country with narcotics known as opioids, those drugs that people become very dependent on and abuse. It's just really an epidemic in the country. And one of the reasons people start on these drugs is they're prescribed them after very painful surgeries.
Wall Street Journal reporter Laura Landreau on what surgeons are experimenting with. She's here in about 10 minutes. Well, in the wake of last week's deadly terror attack in Orlando, there's a new focus on Fort Pierce, Florida, and specifically the South Florida Mosque, where now two of the most infamous Muslim extremists in the U.S. worshipped, Omar Mateen, who carried out the massacre at the Pulse nightclub, and Moner Mohammed Abu Salah, who blew himself up in Syria 2 years ago in an operation for an Al-Qaeda affiliate. Mary Jordan at the Washington Post has a look at the Islamic Center of Fort Pierce. Mary, what's up there?
There's only about 150 people that come every week there. And so everyone from the FBI to the neighbors are going, wow, two of the most dangerous radical Muslims both went through that place and what's going on. And people are right now just asking questions.
All right. Like what, for example?
Well, you know, the key thing is, did they hear something? Were they taught something there? And so far the answer is no. That the first guy who was from 2 hours, a little bit north of here, he came by, he left his car in front of the mosque. He didn't go here all that often. They left the car there. He went to Syria and blew off. He was the first American suicide bomber in Syria. Now, the second guy, the Orlando shooter, went there quite often. And literally 2 days before he went into that gay nightclub in Orlando, he sat on the floor and prayed for an hour. And so, again, people are wondering, you know, what do we need more eyes in these mosques? Did these two people know each other? So far, we know it was just they had a casual acquaintance, but most people are saying that it wasn't like they were bosom buddies, but they did know each other, which is interesting.
Does the FBI have a position on whether or not we should have more eyes in these mosques?
Absolutely. You know, and the only way to do that is to have more Muslims helping the police to, you know, more informants that are in there, that are hearing the chatter, hearing what our people are saying on the edges of all kinds of social meetings in these places. Donald Trump got a lot of attention yesterday when he was saying to the Muslim community, you have to help us more with this.
Yeah. Also, there's this, I guess, perception that Muslim leaders denounce these terrorist attacks, yet say or do things differently when they're inside the mosques. Is that the general feeling here of investigators?
I think there is no general feeling. I think there are several million Muslims in America. Many of them have, most of them, clearly most of them, have absolutely no interest in violence and are sick to their stomach about what's happening. And likewise, their leaders. They're, you know, Northern Virginia, which I know they have some of the most progressive and interesting mosques. There's clearly the last thing on their mind when they go to pray is anything violent. But some leaders, yes. I mean, you know, we've seen that around the world. I've worked a lot in Pakistan and some other countries, and that is the place where they're radicalized. We have not seen that to date in the U.S., but that's the big worry, is that with what we see around the world in Yemen and Pakistan and some other places where there are actually leaders that are militarizing and making people become jihadists, could that come to our shores? And that's, of course, hugely troubling.
Yeah. We're speaking with Mary Jordan, national correspondent at The Washington Post. Her piece is called "Residents of Fort Pierce Are Wondering, How Did One Small Florida Town Produce Two Violent Extremists?" Anybody in Fort Pierce saying that the mosque needs to be closed? Has anyone gone that far?
Nobody in any leadership position. I've been struck by people all saying, we know that there's good and bad in every group, whites, blacks, Muslims, whatever it is. But clearly, you hear the comments, like there's a drugstore nearby, and one guy came in and said, we should start shooting them because they're shooting us.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Some people drove by the mosque and were yelling slurs and screaming. So officially, no, but there is an undercurrent of unease. Interestingly, when I talk to people, people are very nervous about putting their name to anything. They say they don't want to be seen as racist. They don't want to be seen as anti-anything, but of course, they're nervous.
Has the mosque itself issued any kind of statement or said anything?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, they put up a website right away on their Facebook, and they asked that all the members of their community give money and blood to the victims in Orlando. They're raising money. I'm going over there right now again, and I imagine that they are going to try to do more. I think they feel the heat. They feel like they have to show to people this is not what they're about, because it is to say, you know, it's a lot of people, when they heard the leaders of the mosque say, wow, this is bad luck, they wanted more than that. They wanted more than them just saying it was a complete coincidence.
Thanks, Mary. Mary Jordan at The Washington Post. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
A great business needs a stunning website. And with Wix.com, you can do it all by yourself. Wix.com makes it easy to look amazing online, no matter what type of business you're in. Show off your images in a beautiful gallery, grow your contact list, and get all your social media in one place, just the way you want. Your customers are going to love it. So, what are you waiting for? Show the world what you can do. Go to Wix.com and create your stunning website today. It's easy and free.
In business, risks and rewards come with every decision, like moving to the cloud with Office 365. While its benefits include anywhere access and lower costs, cyber threats and user errors can quickly wipe out data and the money you save. Barracuda Essentials for Office 365 provide an added layer of security and functionality for threat protection, email migration, data recovery, and quality of service. Move securely to Office 365. Visit barracuda.com/essentials to learn more.
You're aware of America's problem with prescription drugs. What are doctors doing about it? Wall Street Journal reporter Laura Landreau says a common shoulder surgery has become a testing ground for some novel pain-killing techniques as doctors seek to reduce the use of prescription narcotics known as opioids. Laura, set this up.
Everybody, I think, is aware right now that we've got a problem in this country with narcotics known as opioids, those drugs that people become very dependent on and abuse. It's just really an epidemic in the country. And one of the reasons people start on these drugs is they're prescribed them after very painful surgeries. So in orthopedic surgery, where people are prescribing a lot of these things because those are very painful surgeries, rotator cuff surgery, so the rotator cuff is sort of kind of keeps your shoulder going and holds these muscles and tendons together, that surgery is commonly known as one of the most painful to recover from. And as a result, it's sort of a testing ground in some ways for some of these novel approaches. You know, things that have been around for a while, but not everybody has adopted them. It's too easy to just prescribe a drug. But ways to relieve pain without so much drugs.
All right, so non-addictive pain-killing techniques, as you reference in the story. Explain some of them.
Well, there are a couple of ways to go about this. There are things called nerve blocks. It's literally a local anesthetic, regional and local anesthesia. It's the kind of thing that blocks pain signals. So if you get one of those before surgery, along with what other anesthesia you're getting, that can actually last, in some cases, for up to 24 hours. And in other cases, if they decide to send you home, you could have a little catheter with a little pump in your neck that will continue to infuse that anesthetic for up to 3 days. So the idea is that kind of gets you over the hump of the worst pain, And not everybody is comfortable with these things, of course, but the idea is get you over that hump of the worst pain, and then you can take maybe fewer narcotics, maybe just for a couple of days, and then move into non-narcotic painkillers. Some of the things you're really already familiar with, like Tylenol.
What are you trying to do here? Get past, say, the first 48 hours? Isn't that like any injury, I guess? Is that basically when the worst of the pain is?
That's often the toughest time, and it's sort of like a boomerang effect. People will take the drugs, and then they'll take more drugs, and then the more of those drugs you take, actually, the less pain tolerance you have. And so then they end up, well, let me just stick with these for a couple of more weeks. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the Mayo Clinic Proceedings published a study last year that showed, I think, that 1 in 4 people who start out with a prescription for these for pain end up with longer-term prescriptions. And then, of course, you open yourself up to these risks.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal health writer Laura Landreau. Her story is called Shoulder Surgery is the New Testing Ground for Painkiller Alternatives. All right, so what other techniques are we looking at here?
Well, there are some physical things that can be done. For example, there are something called cryotherapy, which basically is ice. And people will go home, or their physical therapist will provide them with a kind of a shoulder pad that continuously circulates cold water and keeps the swelling down, and that is a big way to reduce pain. There are things physical therapists are working on that include, you know, ultrasound and muscle stimulation, electrical stimulation devices that kind of help in healing. The idea is to try it from many. We're not going to give up narcotics altogether, because let's face it, in some cases that's the only thing that's going to get you over that hump that we've been talking about, that post-surgical time. But the idea is, let's try to minimize the use of these drugs with some of these other things, these nerve blocks. A lot of research going on in this area as well.
What are we waiting for with some of this stuff? As you point out, it's been around for years. Is it just that simple to prescribe a narcotic?
It really is. It really is. And look, surgeons, the orthopedic surgeons, are not trying to get everybody addicted to drugs. But I think what they know is that the patients are going to hate them afterwards, and they really want them. They don't want to be considered barbarians who just inflict pain. And
okay.
You know, that's actually what one doctor said to me. We're not barbarians. You know, we want to help patients get through this pain. But I think there's been more of an understanding that these drugs are not, and by the way, it isn't just the addictive risks. There are a whole population of patients, and I will say I am one among them. I take one of these things, I throw it up right away. There are people who can't tolerate narcotic medications. Narcotics, let's say you decide you're going to give yourself an extra pill. You can have problems like your respiratory suppression. Your breathing can be suppressed. Nausea, vomiting, all kinds of things can happen. People die from narcotic overdoses just because they stopped breathing, not because it was a drug overdose per se. You know, but people are at risk for respiratory depression when they're taking narcotics. So there's all kinds of reasons to get people to use as few of these as possible, and not to make them be in pain, not to make people say, suck it up and suffer, but to literally give them an alternative to these drugs that have so many bad things that come with them.
Thanks, Laura. Wall Street Journal health writer Laura Landreau. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Now for a travel update, and it's brought to you by Lexington Hotels. Come as a guest, leave as a friend at Lexington Inns and Hotels. We'll treat you to exceptional service and a hometown touch. Visit LexingtonHotels.com. If you're headed to New York this summer on vacation and are determined to see Hamilton on Broadway, beware. Scammers are waiting for you. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
It's the hottest ticket in town, and if you're not careful, you can get burned. Would-be Broadway goers are sometimes getting scammed by fake Hamilton tickets. Here with more is Laura Petreca of USA Today. Laura, first of all, what's the demand like for Hamilton tickets?
Oh, the demand is outrageous. The show is sold out through January, and it really is the hottest ticket in town, especially after the Tonys when it nabbed so many awards.
How is this scam working?
Well, there's lots of different scams out there. People sometimes post on Craigslist that they've got tickets, and then folks show up to meet them, and they hand over what looks like legitimate tickets to the theater, but they're actually not. They're just copies that someone made on a high-end printer with high-end technology. So the tickets actually look real, and people think they're getting the real thing, but they're not. Another thing that people are doing are making copies of legitimate tickets. So if you get an e-ticket, you have a barcode on there, you can just make a bunch of copies of that and hand it out to people.
Sounds like a pretty sophisticated operation to be able to make tickets that look exactly like they should.
Yeah, and technology's really helped if you think about it, because now we've got really high-end printers, you've got complicated computer programs that really can dive in and replicate tickets. So the technology has helped some of the scammers get ahead.
Laura, is this something that's been around for a while?
Well, I talked to the president, I talked to the Broadway League, and they said that overall, counterfeit tickets on Broadway are rare, which is good to know. But when a counterfeit bidder goes after a show, they're going to go after the hottest ticket in town. So it's happening with Hamilton, and it's happened with the Book of Mormon. So it has happened in the past. And, of course, it happens with other shows as well beyond Broadway. It happens with concerts, and it happens with sporting events. So the buyer just has to beware.
Yeah, is there any way you can protect yourself from fake tickets?
I think the biggest thing is to not let your emotions get ahead of you, because with a play like with the biggest thing is to not let your emotions get ahead of you. So with a musical like Hamilton or even a concert or a sporting event that you really want to go to, sometimes people get so excited about going that they really don't put a whole lot of thought that they should put into where they're getting their tickets from. So the first thing is to take a deep breath, sit back, compare prices, compare websites. When you look at a website to buy a ticket, first look up the reviews. Go to the Better Business Bureau site and see what kind of grades it has. Take your time to do some due diligence. And in that case, if you do some research, it might help someone from getting scammed.
We're speaking with Laura Petrucca of USA Today about scam tickets for Hamilton. Laura, what can StubHub or any of these other secondary ticket sellers do about this? Are they doing anything about it?
On more of some of the legitimate sites that are selling tickets, the secondary sites, overall, ticket scams are rare because they do a lot of vetting before and a lot of vetting after, but they do happen. Some of the sites I talked to said it happens on rare occasions, less than 1% of the time, but it does happen. And if you're that person standing outside of Hamilton and you can't get in, it's really frustrating. So the sites have different policies. But in general, the best thing to do if you buy a ticket from a secondary seller site and you're standing outside a theater and can't get in is to contact them. Most of them, not all, but most of them will try to get you another ticket for that night. StubHub, in fact, said they're being proactive and they're buying extra tickets so they have them on hand to get a person another entry if they are denied. Also, if you're buying a ticket online, check the policy. If your ticket isn't valid, just make sure to get your money back and your fees back. So, of course, it's so disappointing not to get into the show. But what's even one step worse than that is to not get into the show and not get your money back.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Laura Petrucca at USA Today. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Mailing your letters and packages has just gotten a lot easier thanks to Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can mail and ship anything, anywhere, using just your computer and printer. No more trips to the post office, and it's so easy. Anyone can do it. Just click, print, and mail. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage right from your desk. Stamps.com does all the work for you. They'll even give you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail. You'll never have to go to the post office again. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. A 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. And before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in the code DEAL. That's stamps.com and enter DEAL. One of the names circulating as a potential running mate for Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump is the former mayor of Chattanooga, Tennessee. His current title, U.S. Senator Bob Corker. The story from Joel Ebert at the Tennessean. Joel, tell us about him.
Senator Corker got his start really in business, and he was a contractor essentially working on developing areas around Tennessee, largely his hometown at first in the late 1970s and 80s. He started a company which later ended up selling for a good chunk of change. From there in the 90s, he decided to run for the U.S. Senate and decided, to throw his name in a crowded race. He ended up losing to Senator Bill Frist in the first foray into politics, but that didn't halt Senator Corker. He later became essentially our finance officer for the state level, and he was appointed by the governor at the time and helped to land the VP spot.
So tell me, I guess, how Tennesseans on both sides of the aisle feel about Senator Corker.
So, it seems like he's gotten a lot of criticism from people on both sides. Democrats are concerned because of, in some instances, related to immigration. You've got also his position on the auto bailout really frustrated a lot of union people. He's seen as public enemy number one, in some instances to the unions out here, largely because he was fighting against the unionization effort for the Chattanooga Volkswagen plant that they have. But also on the Republican side, he's been hit with criticism. Some on the Tea Party side say that he's not conservative enough, that he is a rhino, that he helped kind of formulate a plan that ended up passing with the Iran deal. And he, to his defense, he comes back and says, that I try and work with everybody, that he says that, he's trying to not use partisanship while reaching his decisions. And so, he is kind of appreciated on both sides of the spectrum by many people.
Got it. We're speaking with Joel Ebert, State House reporter at The Tennessean. He's got a piece entitled From Chattanooga Mayor to Possible VP, Bob Corker's Rise to Prominence. Talk about Senator Corker. All right, so why is his name so high on the rumor list, do you think, when it comes to potential VP candidates for Donald Trump?
Sure. So one of the issues with Donald Trump is that he doesn't have a whole lot of foreign policy experience. And I didn't really talk about it earlier, but when Senator Corker became senator in 2006, he started to dabble into certain things. And it was the auto bailout that kind of helped him. It was also the financial crisis of the country. But eventually, he was serving on the Foreign Relations Committee in 2007. Eventually, he starts digging deeper and deeper into foreign relations. And he really became a go-to player in terms of that issue. And so by 2015, he's named chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And now he's meeting with, foreign dignitaries throughout the country or throughout the world every day. And he's kind of seen as one of these main players when it comes to foreign policy. And so I think that's his main stronghold while Donald Trump is considering him. There are many other people that he's probably, their name is out there, and we've seen several people, including another lawmaker, another congressman from Tennessee. But some people think that he has a very good chance because of this May meeting that Donald Trump and Senator Corker had, which they say was strictly about policy. Also, you've seen Senator Corker not necessarily come to the defense of Donald Trump in light of this attack on Judge Curiel, but more basically saying, hey, this is a time for him to press forward, to pivot. He's offered some sort of explanation or challenge to the Republican nominee.
Thanks, Joel. Joel Ebert, reporter at The Tennessean. 21 minutes now before the hour. On this weekend, for many of us, a self-storage unit is seen as a temporary place to stash stuff when we're relocating or perhaps dealing with some major life event. But here's the problem. Market Watch reporter Amy Hoke says we almost always keep our things in storage longer than we thought we would and waste money as a result. We need to get better at decluttering. Amy, what'd you look at?
Well, we looked at the stats here. It shows that the storage companies are doing very well these days. Rents are going up. Vacancies are going down. A lot of people are storing stuff, and that's partly due to new household formation. People are moving. People are maybe moving out from mom and dad's, or people are making a switch in housing, and they're using storage to kind of help them with that move, manage that move. The problem is that people put stuff in storage, and almost always they keep it in there longer than they had anticipated they would. And so with the story, I just kind of looked at, what people could do to get around getting that storage unit to begin with, how to kind of declutter your life a little bit so you don't need to store that stuff, because a lot of times you go back in that locker and it's just a bunch of junk anyway.
Wow. All right. So, almost right out of the gate in your story, you had somebody who said keeping stuff too long might be indicative of deeper problems.
Yes. we have a hard time letting go. You know, we have a hard time decluttering. And I think that it's just easier to amass just a lot of stuff that we don't need. There's stuff that's inexpensive. You know, to do a shop to Target, and it's easy to just throw some extra things in there, and we're not getting rid of stuff in our house. It just keeps piling in. So you have to really make room for new stuff to come in. And that's one of the great tips that I got from someone who I talked with from Apartment Therapy, which is a great site. He said that you really have to leave a certain percentage of empty space just in order to bring stuff in that you want to bring in on a regular basis.
Wow. All right. So what do we recommend here in terms of decluttering?
Well, one thing is you have to kind of define your goals, your goals, and then also the people who you live with. Everybody's definition of clutter is different. Some people need to have the surfaces in the home clean off daily. Some people can go through papers every week. You know, they can manage it that way. You have to define what your goals are going to be, and then just start small. You know, do a drawer at a time when you can, and maximize space, investing in storage systems that are going to be maximize, you know, the space that you do have, like vertical hanging systems or under the bed drawers. And there's some other tips, too, that we included here, too, just setting limits, knowing how many pairs of black pants you're going to allow yourself to keep, creating an outbox, a space that if you're not sure where things are going to go, you kind of use it as a halfway house so that you come back to it maybe in a week and you decide whether you're going to get rid of it or donate it or sell it.
Thanks, Amy. Market Watch reporter Amy Hoke, who's based in Chicago. 14 minutes now before the hour on this weekend. Give your employees the power to do their best work with new, powerfully performing Dell Latitude business class laptops and 2-in-1s. Now with Windows 10, the fastest, smoothest, most secure Windows ever. Your team can reduce downtime by 50%. And boost productivity with 4 times faster performance and 3 times more battery life. Learn more at Dell.com/radio. That's Dell.com/radio. Everyone knows that business is all about numbers. Consider the numbers the state of Michigan can offer your business, like being a top 10 pro-business state, or 2,000, the number of unnecessary regulations Michigan has eliminated in the last 5 years, and 6, Michigan's rank for best entrepreneurial climate, which all adds up to the one state that has all that and more, Michigan. Go to MichiganBusiness.org to learn more. A vegetable trying to make a name for itself now has its own publicity team. Broccoli Rob is emerging as a star of food blogs, Instagram feeds, and the daytime television circuit, thanks to a concerted campaign to position the vegetable as the next nutritional powerhouse. It's a story from Wall Street Journal reporter Vanessa Fermans. Vanessa, what exactly is Broccoli Rob?
Broccoli Rob, it's a cruciferous vegetable. Which means it's in the same family as kale. Other vegetables like cauliflower, broccoli. It's actually known originally as by the name rapini, but it's been in America for, well, nearly a century, and one company that sells most of the broccoli rob, grows and sells it in America, is Andy Boy, and they are behind a new campaign to try to promote broccoli rob into the next it superfood.
Wow. All right. So what is it about this particular superfood then that does great things for our bodies, I guess?
Well, it's very nutritionally dense. You know, it has a lot of the same properties as kale. It's basically has a packed with vitamins, and this is what the company is essentially trying to promote, that it's you know, very healthy alternative to a lot of the popular leafy greens that we're seeing out there today.
Interesting. So is it more nutrient rich than, say, just broccoli?
That I don't know exactly. It has a very bold taste. That's one of the marketing challenges behind it. It's beloved, you know, it's very well known as an old school sort of Italian-American side dish, or in classic dishes like pasta and sausage. And now the company is really trying to sort of revamp that image and make it something that you would think of to have in, say, like you would kale, like smoothies or pesto or, you know, in salads, that sort of thing.
How about that? All right. So what kind of marketing push is behind this?
Well, it's, I mean, the vegetable is just really a great example of what we're seeing a lot more of in the produce aisle these days. It used to be that vegetables, fruits really didn't get much marketing muscle behind them because, you know, a lot of the companies behind them are pretty small. You know, they're pretty small growers or packers in California, and unless they have like a big industry board behind them, say like the avocado industry, there really isn't a lot of money they can put toward publicity or marketing. But that's really changed a lot with, you know, since the kale sensation, since social media has allowed a lot of more low-cost marketing to take place online. And then also the rise of a lot of these digital influencers who are anything from food bloggers to Instagram stars and Pinterest stars. And these people also have a lot riding and trying to promote the next it thing. And this whole confluence of factors have really allowed for, you know, for something as obscure as broccoli rabe to have its own marketing campaign.
All right. Thanks, Vanessa. Wall Street Journal reporter Vanessa Fermans, bridging the gap, too, between the older folks who prefer broccoli rabe and the younger folks who really don't eat it much, is going to be a big part of this marketing campaign for broccoli rabe as well. It's 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. How about a list of the best quotes from and about dads for Father's Day from Reader's Digest and SheKnows.com from comedian Rita Rudner. Quote, I gave my father $100 and said, buy yourself something that will make your life easier. So he went out and bought a present for my mother. Bob Odenkirk from Breaking Bad. Quote, my daughter got me a world's best dad mug. So we know she's sarcastic. From TV's Jimmy Fallon. Father's Day is important because, besides being the day on which we honor dad, it's the one day of the year that Brookstone does any business. From photographer Ann Geddes, quote, any man can be a father, but it takes someone special to be a dad. From comedian Jim Gaffigan, quote, raising my kids may be a thankless job with ridiculous hours, but at least the pay sucks. And perhaps best from Mark Twain, quote, when I was a boy of 14, my father was so ignorant, I could hardly stand to have the old man around. But when I got to be 21, I was astonished at how much the old man had learned in 7 years. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Happy Father's Day weekend. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.